Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Okay, you have found Forum, Nature Biotechnology's podcast, where we speak with leading researchers in the field about recent papers or breakthroughs or just general topics of interest. This is episode 9, and for this one, we have a roundtable on precision oncology. And I should say that this is part of our 25th anniversary content, meaning that the journal Nature Biotechnology has now been around 25 years, and this is part of the content that we are producing to commemorate that anniversary. This roundtable is run by Marcus Elsner, our senior editor, and I'm with him now. And I think the first thing, even before we talk about the guests, Marcus, is that we should talk about why we decided to do this roundtable on this topic.
Well, I think the field has been around for, two decades now. And I think one thing that we keep realizing is that in terms of actually benefiting patients, we are not anywhere near where we thought we would be 20 years ago. We thought we'd check in where the progress is and what we can expect in the next 10, 20 years in terms of translating precision personalized treatment to the clinic.
Yeah, this concept that 20 years ago we started thinking about, okay, there's going to be a cancer treatment for every single person based on their genetic makeup and their tumor. And we haven't quite seen that translate over to the clinic yet.
There's definitely progress. I mean, 20 years ago, we got Gleevec approved, which targets a specific fusion gene very effectively in certain leukemias. There are other cases like BRAF inhibitors in melanoma that were approved 10 years ago that have very high initial response rate. But for most cancers, it's hard to find specific targetable mutations when you just look at the genome. But there are also many ideas where we could go from here to avoid problems in the clinic with new technologies, new approaches.
Can you tell me who is in this roundtable with you?
Yeah, so we have really two of the pioneers in the field. So we have Elaine Mardis, who is at the Nationwide Children's Hospital. She's a co-director at the Institute for Genomic Medicine there. She's also the Steve and Cindy Rasmussen Endowed Chair in Genomic Medicine. And in addition to that, holds professorship for pediatrics at the Ohio State University College of Medicine. And she has really been instrumental in the characterization of many tumors initially, like leukemia, breast cancer, glioblastoma, lung cancers. And now she focuses more on childhood cancers. And the second guest is Lillian Hsu, and she's a senior medical oncologist at the Princess Margaret Cancer Center and a professor of medicine at the University of Toronto. And she also heads the program for phase one clinical trials. And probably most relevant for this discussion, she's also the co-director of the Ontario-wide Cancer Target Nucleic Acid Evaluation Program, OCTANE. And that is a dedicated program in Canada where genomic data or molecular data is used to select approved therapies or facilitate the use of targeted therapies or direct patients to immune therapies or other clinical trials.
Okay, sounds good. Off you go. Here's Marcus Elsner and our Precision Oncology Roundtable.
Lillian, Elaine, thank you so much for making the time to talk to us today. And I guess we can just start to talk about the topic of the podcast, and that is personalized cancer medicine. And I guess my first question is that I think cancer treatment has been personalized to a certain extent for a very long time. So what is the paradigm shift that is occurring now compared to what we have done before? Maybe Lillian can start.
Yeah, I think you're right, Marcus. I mean, as a physician, I would say we have always been personalized because every patient in front of us is a different individual. So therefore, I think most of us feel that the term personalized is probably not the best term. And I would certainly prefer precision cancer medicine. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to use the cliche, treating the right patient at the right time with the right drug, I think we are still obviously trying to aspire to that because that's what we are always doing in drug development and translational science. But I think the field is moving so fast with novel technologies that we're now going beyond next generation sequencing and genomics. There is a lot more omics that can help us understand more. And obviously the whole era of immuno-oncology bring us to a whole new era of precision medicine as well. So to me, this is much more than, you know, NGS 1.0. We're now in the multi-omic world where we can learn so much more about the host immunity, the tumor microenvironment, the tumor cells and intrinsic, extrinsic mechanisms, and putting it all together beyond just one drug, one gene, one target.
Right. I completely agree, Lillian. This is precision medicine, and we definitely have moved past, you know, NGS 1.0. Especially in the pediatric setting, which is where most of my work is happening, which is a little slower to catch up, quite frankly, to precision medicine compared to adults. But, you know, this is something that we're really focused on. And with regard to the multi-omic component, I would agree that in the pediatric cancer world, you know, we rarely have even a single driver that can often be discerned by simply looking at DNA alone. So fusion drivers are very prevalent. They're much, much more readily identified through RNA-seq based analysis. Indeed, we can also look at the downstream impact of epigenetic drivers, which are also quite common in pediatric cancers, by looking at outlier RNA expression and ultimately protein expression. So these are really the aspects that I think flesh things out significantly. I think also in the adult cancer world, as you said, we're moving beyond this single mutation equals drug equals response paradigm because we know that that's really not the reality, you know, in terms of if you apply that, you don't get a uniform response across patients because patients are very unique and individualized in terms of the other mutations, the other genes that are in the mix. And, you know, I think the field is now moving to this much more advanced approach of looking at the genotype in full rather than a single gene indicator of likely response.
I guess that's many cancers have, quite as you say, complicated mutational makeups. I guess a physician cannot just look at the data by hand and make up his or her mind what drugs, combinations of drugs to give. So how do you see computational approaches developing that kind of help physicians to make this kind of decisions?
Yeah, this is a really important topic, and I would say very much timely. You know, in the past, you know, we finish one clinical trial, we have our correlative data set, and then we sit down with our biostatistician or bioinformatician and say, hey, we have these responses and these non-responses. Can you make some sense out of this data with the correlative studies? I think this is not the right approach anymore. Obviously, it's really a learning system that is continuous. You feed the information, you learn from each case at real time. And, you know, now with liquid biopsies, we can actually understand how cancers change dynamically before it's really impractical to biopsy somebody repeatedly over time because it's too invasive. Now we have non-invasive technologies such as liquid biopsy, such as radiomics. And I think we really need to learn how to, you know, get information from that kind of information real time and constantly learn. And this is where data sharing is really, really important. And you know, AACR has done a great job in the Genie project, ASCO in the Cancer Link. I think this is no longer just aspirational. I think this is now reality that we can do that in a big scale internationally.
Can you maybe explain to our listeners what those projects are that you just referred to?
Elaine's the AACR ex-president, so I'm going to let her talk about AACR Genie.
So it's really, as Lillian said, it's a data sharing world, and I think this potentiates so much. So Genie was started about 5 years ago as an initiative of Charles Sawyers, who was the president of AACR at the time, and really has, you know, grown significantly, now getting close to, I think, 100,000 records from individuals treated at a variety of centers throughout the world, studied by NGS-based methods, as we were talking about earlier, assigned to either a clinical trial or an FDA or European Drug Commission approved target, and then followed with respect to outcomes. And so this potentiates this big data world that Lillian is referring to, where we now have these very accomplished machine learning experts who can, because of the accessibility of these data, and that's key, now start to put together the paradigmatic, you know, combination of mutations that equals best outcomes. And I think, you know, while that sounds really complicated, it actually improves it for, if you will, the average oncologist who may not have even grown up in this era that we've been in for the last 10 or 15 years, because these tools now really allow fairly straightforward input with a fairly straightforward output. So it's really now the accessibility of the machine learning tools to help, you know, a person with a molecular profile in hand for a given patient input that information and come back with a series of likely single therapies, combination therapies, immunotherapy, if you will, or what have you, or clinical trials that the patient, you know, could go on to, although that's less likely because, you know, we haven't really looked at the outcome of those trials yet. So to me, that's really the gain for the field as a whole, because we can equal access of oncologists and patients to the knowledge that's out there that's been created by these large data compendiums.
I think with those machine learning tools, one of the issues one can potentially see is that different groups, different researchers will come up with different ways of modeling this. So how do we design trials to test those automated or semi-automated tools to make treatment decisions and compare one to another?
Yeah, I mean, you know, heterogeneity doesn't exist only in machine learning platforms. Heterogeneity exists in every aspect of our research. So I'm not worried too much about that, because if everything is the same, you know, then life would not be as interesting and our battle against cancer would have been solved already. I think we obviously need to think about how to homogenize and learn from these kinds of data sets. But at the same time, I think we have to understand that heterogeneity will exist, and we have to factor that into our understanding. Obviously, clinical trials need to evolve as we evolve into this field in personalized precision medicine, as you asked. And you know, can it be just N of one, that every patient is his own control or her own control, and we compare against the world without precision medicine and see whether they derive benefit because of a precision approach? I mean, that's obviously one way, but I think we could be a bit more pragmatic in design. I mean, obviously, there are certain things still common to different patients in different subsets that we can still group them together and look at, you know, within that group, the heterogeneity does exist, but we can still, you know, have some overarching principles that tie them together to design the trial. for example, basket trout is such an idea where it's sort of the first generation of tying together heterogeneity patients in the same basket. And I think if we move into the next generation of multi-omic trials, similarly, we can think about platform trials that can tie in some common elements to understand different subsets that have some common elements together.
I think it's also the case that the way, and I'm certainly not a machine learning expert, so don't take this the wrong way, but that the way that these machine learning approaches go, essentially they train on a data set, which could be one clinical trial, a basket or umbrella trial, and then they test the, sort of machine learning approach on a second set of data to compare sort of what was, projected from the training set onto what is projected for the test set. So with two complete trials worth of data, you could at least at a first pass benchmark the performance of one specific approach that would then allow, in terms of positive predictive value, for example, that would then allow providers to evaluate that particular approach, maybe relative to all others. Your point, though, is well taken. We do need to set up a standardized framework in which an oncologist can understand a given test and use that, benchmark to understand how well that performs on a second data set that's not the training data set.
And just to explain, so basket trials are when you have different cancers or different tissues of origin and you combine them based on some molecular profile, but umbrella trials is we have one cancer from one origin and then stratify the patients again according to molecular profiles. That's correct, right?
Right,
that's right.
Yeah. And multiple drugs to offer to those patients.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I guess one practical problem is that that many hospitals will face is that, as you said in the beginning, we have moved beyond just sequencing the genome, providing RNA-seq proteomics data. I think probably that will be quite far off for most cancer patients just based on the cost and availability of technology. So in practice, which parameters, which omics technologies are likely to be the most useful if you had to prioritize, do RNA-seq, DNA-seq, proteomics on a patient sample?
I will speak first and say that I find these arguments highly ironic because the cost of the cancer drugs that are going to be prescribed exceed the cost of these tests in extremis. So I'll just lay that out there. But I take your point, Marcus, but I do feel like it's a bit of a false concept.
Yeah, that's actually my next question. What are the drivers of precision medicine costs, and are they significant in terms of everything else that that creates costs in cancer care? So I guess you already answered that.
Well, I kind of did, but let's go with it a little bit further. I think it's important, and I would love to hear Lillian's thoughts on this. In a world where we better diagnose a cancer's vulnerabilities upfront, and the irony here, of course, is that patients who get onto the clinical trials typically are quite advanced. They've been through multiple lines of therapy. They're reasonably well, but they're also quite ill. And so I think, lung cancer, because it's furthest along in the precision medicine paradigm, because it's one of the most prevalent cancers, may have some learnings for us over the nearness of time. But I do feel like, and I'll just be brief here, that the full picture of the health economics is rarely considered in the context of precision medicine versus old school, all size fits one, chemo and or radiation therapy. Just in terms of, the likelihood of success. And another aspect that doesn't often get talked about, which is especially important in pediatric and young adult cancers, which is the downstream side effects of aggressive chemotherapy and radiation, which also have a cost. So Lillian, please comment.
Yeah, I totally agree with Elaine. It's, we've been, even from NGS 1.0 trying to sort of demonstrate the utility, clinical utility of precision cancer medicine. And it's such a hard thing to do because sort of the collateral benefit of precision medicine is very hard to quantitate. You know, somebody being able to return to work and assume a normal work life, how do you measure that, right? Instead of being sick from chemotherapy toxicities, you know, can not go to work, cannot take care of their family, versus somebody who is, you know, able to return to work, feel great. Those are very difficult to measure dollars. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I totally agree that cost of drugs is a big issue, and there has been many written about that issue already. And I also think that technologies in time do go down in pricing and costs. Like, you know, NGS was so expensive when, you know, it first came out. Now a lot of people get it done on a fairly regular basis. I think, you know, and I also think that the multi-omic concept, when you ask which one is most relevant, I think is context cancer dependent. You know, you cannot say, like, sarcoma, for example, is probably a very epigenetic disease as we know it, and doing NGS for genomics for mutations, you probably won't get anywhere for a driver. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I don't think we can say one size fits all. We need to think about the context. And this is where the learning systems and big data would really help us, because in your own center, you have, like, you know, 50 such cases, but in the whole world, there are probably thousands of those cases. Hmm. You can only learn from thousands of cases and not from 50 cases. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to push more in terms of the whole data sharing culture, because I think that's really important. And this is now the time that we do and not just talk.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
So does that include also, I mean, there must be plenty of off-label use of drugs that is just happening and it's probably not recorded in a systematic way. Is that, so we already talked about one such initiative. So are there worldwide initiatives to systematically collect this kind of data, that even N of one treatment trials that one physician does in some hospital somewhere that could still probably be valuable for to contribute another data point?
Yeah, there are a lot of off-label initiative to collect data, such as, you know, ASCO's TAPER study, the Canadian CAPTURE study, the Netherlands, for example, has their DRUB study, where drugs are obtained from pharmaceutical companies and patients who have specific genetic alterations are put on these drugs on an off-label basis, but under the auspice of clinical trials, not just, you know, haphazard use and you never know what happens to them. I think these efforts are important, and these groups have already from the get-go agreed to share that data to learn from each other. And certainly, I think that's the way to go. I mean, fortunately or unfortunately, I live in a country where off-label drug use is not as possible. So we have, you know, no other chance to get drugs for patients for off-label use unless we enrolled on clinical trials, because self-pay is just prohibitive. So I think these are important initiatives to continue in as we move further in the next generation 2.0 kind of era.
So maybe you can go back to the underlying science a bit. So Lillian, you mentioned liquid biopsies and the potential utility of this. So where do you see the state of liquid biopsy use and utility in the clinic? And what are the hurdles for implementing them in standard cancer care?
I'm sure both Elaine and I will have a lot to talk about liquid biopsy. And I think this is a game changer. I truly do. I think for us as oncologists, you know, we're used to radiological CAT scans. To me, this is a molecular scan. And to have a molecular lens to see what's going on a repeated timeline on patients who have a cancer that keeps changing, that's a big deal. And we can afford to do this because it's non-invasive. And I think we can learn so much more from different omics and liquid biopsies. But I'll pass to Elaine.
Right. I mean, I would love to have lots of experience with liquid biopsy in the pediatric setting. We're just starting to push in this direction, given the lag in, you know, precision medicine overall in the pediatric setting. But I am similarly excited about not just tracking the known mutations as they ebb and flow in response to therapy, which I think is incredibly important. And as we know, will be much more predictive of, for example, emerging acquired resistance than waiting for the next imaging cycle to come along. But I also, you know, we're also exploring, for example, from liquid biopsy, the opportunity to look for activation of different subsets of the immune system, which can become incredibly important in the context of then invoking an immunotherapy, a course for that patient. And in my own research, this is really focused on brain cancers, which are, as an adult, a very poor outcome cancer for kids. So I do think there's a huge amount of potential. I guess the other thing to mention just around liquid biopsy, of course, is early detection and even a mode that is now being referred to as precision prevention, which probably has the most cachet in patients or people who are going to become patients based on an underlying susceptibility to develop cancer. And I'm actually really excited to think about what that's going to mean for those individuals, as we're better able to detect them genetically with NGS, you know, how do we now couple that with a liquid biopsy and, you know, accelerated or more frequent imaging, maybe even immune interventions that could be preventive as opposed to something that we do after they develop their cancer. So I think that's a huge area that's really largely untapped, but definitely moving forward.
So technology-wise, at the moment, I assume that detecting mutations in cell-free DNA is the most advanced. So what can we expect to see in terms of detecting expression profiles or maybe even protein expression? So we just published a paper where the group of Nir Friedman did ChIP-seq on cell-free DNA. People have looked at nucleosome positioning for detecting active and inactive genes. So do you think we can go much further than that to learn more about the proteome and the transcriptome of the tumors?
Yeah, for sure, Marcus. I mean, you know, we have a lot of interest in our center with methylated DNA with Daniel DiCarvalho's group. And because the attraction is obviously, it's not mutational based, so there could be different patterns related to different methylation patterns in cancers across different tumor types, such that you don't need to have mutations based on somatic changes in the genes. So that to me it's very important because not all patients have detectable mutations. Some cancers are very genomically silent and quiet. So not be able to use liquid biopsy in those cases would be a pity. One area to also, you know, echo Elaine's point is we are very interested in the MRD, the molecular residual disease setting, and similarly to molecular prevention. You know, to be very frank, advanced cancer patients, we cannot do very much, no matter what we try. Even if we detect a bit earlier their relapse or their resistance, we are going to not change much of their longevity. But preventing cancers who have high risk to come back and preventing cancers who have predisposition to develop cancer, that's a much, much more, you know, important goal.
And I would just add briefly that in the context of the transcriptome and proteome, especially for my research, we've been really focusing on RNA coming out of exosomal or extracellular vesicles. So this is a protective environment to some extent, as opposed to just straight plasma or serum for the RNA, you know, that we can then evaluate using a variety of different methods to understand the changes in that patient over time. So it's definitely not limited just to circulating DNA.
I guess circulating or any kind of circulating biomarker gives you one window into the heterogeneity of the tumor. Are there other ways of dealing with heterogeneity than looking at those blood and plasma-based markers?
I mean, single cell is obviously, if you can get at tissue, you know, a very current mode that I think is going to, you know, it's exploded, let's face it. And I think that's been very informative, especially with respect to tumor microenvironment, you know, really cataloging all of the cells, if possible, that are in the tumor. I'm actually excited about the falling cost of sequencing because I do feel like in some ways single cell has been, you know, is quite expensive or has been in the past. And so some of those data sets have been a little bit sparse. And maybe with decreased cost of sequencing, we can see a greater sampling of tumors to really understand the breadth of a given tumor type in terms of its molecular composition and its composition over time. If for example, in a therapy intermediate where you have sort of a pre-treatment versus post-treatment. Mm-hmm. And we're doing this now in single cell in mouse models. But ultimately, yeah, developing it into understanding the patient's cancer, I think in that therapeutic intervention interval is going to be really important.
And one other area that also is non-invasive and can look at heterogeneity is obviously imaging. We are doing a lot of work in radiomics, for example, and looking at not just the size and, you know, the shape, et cetera, but also different aspects of the radiological imaging that you're doing on a day-to-day basis, CTs and MRIs, that, you know, many groups have actually been able to create radiomic signatures that can predict outcome. I think that, again, captures more than just one area where you're biopsying, you know, one small part of the tumor that has potentially metastasized to multiple areas. So I think that's a very exciting area as well.
Yeah, and maybe as we study more at the single cell level, we'll come up with new contrast reagents, for example, that could be used in with an imaging modality and could tell us a lot more about, you know, the heterogeneity in that patient's tumor.
Since you mentioned mouse models, Elaine, where do you see the role that basic research can play in developing approaches to sequence different different aspects of the tumors or to develop machine learning algorithms to better model drug or treatment selection?
Well, the current feeling, I think, there, Marcus, is around patient-derived organoids as a screening vehicle, right? Because, you know, the mouse models have taught us a huge amount, there's no doubt, but the homogeneity of the mouse strain background is very different than our own. In most cases anyway, and indeed, you know, there in mouse models, you typically have sort of a known genotype, right, because it's been introduced by a variety of genetic tricks. And so I'm, you know, not doing this in my own work, but really excited about what's going to develop out over time with these organoid-based systems in three-dimensional culture with drug screening, because we can also genotype the organoids and understand, much like we do for a patient, what is that, you know, makeup. Now, I think one question about organoids which remains and could be a gotcha in this regard is sort of if you have a heterogeneous tumor that you then use to make organoid culture, do those organoids adequately represent the heterogeneity? And I think that's, you know, not a well-established or well-known entity just now. So there will have to be some caution taken there, but I think it's an exciting area.
Do you also feel that those organoid models or PDX models, or even maybe just patient cells, tumor cells in a dish, could be a valuable addition to all the omics-based approaches that we discussed so far, just to basically for each patient test drugs before we give them to a patient?
I think the challenge there, Lillian should address this too, but I think the challenge there is just that depending upon the type of cancer, we often don't have the luxury of time to do those experiments in terms of the, you know, relative time frame of when a patient needs to be diagnosed and treated versus how long it would take to do the screening. There are some systems that are utilized for that that have been published and are being actively worked on now. So, you know, that may change over time, but I think that's probably the biggest challenge.
Yeah, I agree. A lot of these sort of co-clinical trials, the issue is the time. It's hard to sort of be able to preempt the clinic, and patients need to make decisions fairly quickly. But maybe we can learn from tumors like the one that the patient has and apply that knowledge mm-hmm. to that particular patient. But I'm sure, obviously, over time, these things become easier and faster, and we can be able to apply it more real time. But I agree that organoids are very exciting, and hopefully we can you know, be able to turn them around faster and be able to be more reflective of what happens in the patients as well, given that the environment is a lot more complex, obviously, in a patient.
The other possibility there, of course, is that not for that patient, but for future patients, you could also populate data around organoid genotypes and responses and add that into your machine learning based approach like we were talking about earlier. So that may be, in the fullness of time, a valuable adjunct to the real time data from patients.
I think my final question that I have is, I'm sure when you do all the omics based analysis, you find potential drug targets that you would really like to target, but there's just no approved drug for that particular target. But there might have been early clinical trials with the drug that proved safe, but just not efficient as a monotherapy. What's your thinking on how can we utilize that enormous research resource that has been built up over decades of drugs that are safe, but have just never been successful enough in earlier clinical trials, but might be for subsets of patients?
I think if we're going to do that, Marcus, we have to do this under a clinical trial, obviously, because mm-hmm. I certainly don't want to sort of take a drug from, you know, the pharmacy and say, hey, take this because I think it's going to help you for your cancer based on what I think from your multi-omic analysis. So again, I think, you know, there might be a lot of drugs that we have that we're not aware of that could have these kinds of potential. Maybe not as potent as we would like, but maybe we can learn from them as we become more sophisticated in this experience. So, but I think, as I said, I would only want to do something like that in the under the auspice of a trial.
Yeah, I actually thought where you were going to go with that was to undruggable targets, which, you know, continue to be a vexing, you know, challenge. KRAS comes to mind, for example. But we, of course, have new insights thanks to medicinal chemistry and other, you know, sort of biology-based approaches to understand the co-activating, you know, proteins with some of these undruggable targets. And they're there in pediatric cancers as well. You know, I could name off a list of them. So I think I'm really excited about re-energizing the medicinal chemistry and structural biology-based approaches to undruggable targets and really starting to think outside of the box. And it looks like some of these efforts are now starting to pay off with therapies that are in clinical trials.
Yeah, I think that's all the questions I had. So, is there anything that I forgot to ask, something that you feel should really be mentioned on the podcast?
Want to talk about real-world evidence, Lillian?
We need Deb Shrike for this.
That's right.
I think we cover a lot of grounds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I think real-world evidence is actually a good question. So what is the real-world evidence that what we're currently doing is benefiting patients? Because I know that there was controversy about that in the past.
There still is to this day. Yeah. I mean, we're sort of laughing because Lillian and I back when people were actually meeting in person, which would have been last January, actually co-chaired an AACR meeting on real world evidence, which was a real eye opener for me in terms of the potential for RWE and really understanding, you know, the paradigm that I was talking about earlier, which is, you know, the reality of clinical trial patients and who gets enrolled versus the actual results from targeted therapies in the real world once they are through the clinical trial process and once they're approved. So to me, that I think is a bit of an untapped resource. I'd love to hear Lillian's current thoughts on it, but that's a lot of what we explored during that meeting is sort of how do we get to that and really, you know, address these voices that are saying, you know, these drugs are expensive and they provide little to no clinical benefit, because those voices are definitely there. Lillian, I'll hand off to you. And
yeah, there is a huge initiative in many groups, especially pharmaceutical companies, that are sort of investing a lot of funds in looking at this whole RWE question, because they obviously want to know what happens when their drugs are approved, who's using it, and what are they seeing in terms of benefit that are not being, you know, collected otherwise. And it's a tough area. You think that, you know, just collecting data from whatever's happening in your hospital should be easy. It is probably much harder than clinical trials, to be honest, because it's not following a protocol. You're collecting, you know, day-to-day EMR that is often, you know, not in a regulated format that you can just pull out. You have to homogenize it that you can understand it. It's a science that I think it's going beyond today's discussion.
We can have another podcast on that.
You should.
Sometime down the road, yeah.
Yeah, you should.
Yeah, so thank you very much. I think this was super enlightening for me and hopefully for our listeners too.
All right, episode 9 of Forum is complete. Thank you to our two guests, Elaine Martis and Lillian Hsu. Obviously, we could not have done this without you and your insight. It's much appreciated. A note or reminder that our March issue marks 25 years of Nature Biotechnology. We have created content specifically to commemorate that anniversary. You can find it in those pages. It is also on the homepage of Nature Biotech, and we will have more as the year moves along. So happy birthday to this journal. If you'd like to comment on Nature Biotechnology, this podcast, or anything that we do, you can find us on Twitter. Our handle is @NatureBiotech. A nod of appreciation to the Midwest Quiet for letting us use your music in this podcast. And that is all. I hope you enjoyed episode 9 of Forum.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.